Blog Talk Radio.
And colonialism. Our call-in number this evening is 347-857-3293. This is our Tuesday, September 1st, 2015 edition of Ralph Pointer's What's Happening. I want to say tonight that one of the topics we will be covering is what should the primary, especially in terms of Black Lives Matter, the truth unfolds. In addition, we will be discussing readings and updates from the political prisoners. We are upgrading and intensifying our efforts to pull together all groups and all organizations to free our political prisoners now. In addition, we have some panel discussions for you this evening. Organizing against unnecessary immunizations will be discussed. What is human nature will be discussed. And we are really privileged to have a former Black Panther and political prisoner give us excerpts from the Black Activist Writers Guild. I am one of the co-hosts for this evening. And my name is Betty Davis. I'm from the New Abolitionist Movement. Our position is if one of us is chained, none of us are free. And without further ado, I'd like to turn our microphone over to our fabulous general, our political hero, our political prisoner, a former political prisoner, a wonderful educator, a fighter for community control of education, and the person that helps us analyze just where we're going and how we need to get there. Brother Pointer, are you in the house tonight?
Yes, I am, and I say hello, as Ralph Schoenman loves to say, brothers and sisters, and as Ward Churchill says, my family. And they mean the same thing. Those of us who have a unity of purpose, there is no other unity. And our purpose is to extend freedom and better well-being, a sharing of the earth by all. And we are first charged with the task of freeing those political folks who are now incarcerated by this corrupt system for doing the things that we talk about we talk about the struggle for liberation. They did it. And as long as they are behind the walls, as long as they are incarcerated, it is upon us, and it is a shame upon us, those who propose to be progressive, that we have not freed them. Now, I know everybody looks at their TV, and one of the things that the American Marines, this oppressive army of occupation around the world, this oppressive police force says, we never leave ours behind. And I charge all of those progressive people, never leave our soldiers behind. Now, I'm going to get back to what I do every week, and I'm going to read my credo. The overriding element in every situation or circumstance in a black life is racism. Birth, elementary school, housing, health, food, etc. Black lives have never mattered except during slavery and other circumstances where money is being made by our laborers for others. The modern death penalty, 80% black, moved lynching indoors. The police, as the army of occupation, have taken lynching outside again. The lynch mob is the racist system, including the courts and the media. Because the lives of our heroes and sheroes who once protected us in our community do not matter to us, the people, our political prisoners are now dying in captivity. They are tortured and isolated. Only armed struggle can recreate our image in our own minds as well as the minds of others. Wake up. Now is the time. And now I'm going to make a short moment to explain what this statement says, because I have heard people say to me, Ralph, the black lives of our heroes and the white lives of our heroes and sheroes who once protected us in our community do matter to us, the people. And I say, yes, but too few of us, for we have many examples of people who free their political prisoners. And the main example, we don't have to go around the world for this example. All we have to do is look at our brothers and sisters in the Puerto Rican freedom movement. They have a unity of purpose to extend a decent way of life, to end oppression for their people. They have gotten their political prisoners out, except for Oscar Lopez Rivera, and we're working on it. They are working on it. All people who are progressive are working on it. But black people who claim to be progressive are not working on it for people of color. And the reason why I say that all we have to do is look at what is real, we ask ourselves, well, how did the Puerto Rican organization get their political prisoners out of jail? The answer is very simple. No one in the Puerto Rican or Latino community who claimed to be progressive could be elected if they did not speak out on behalf of freeing their political prisoners, and our political prisoners who happen to be Puerto Rican. And I'm pointing out the difference in community action. And we all, 90% of black women, and I think it was a number like 85 or 86% of black men, voted for Obama, and did they demand that he free our political prisoners? And the answer is no. And so, therefore, I say, black lives do not matter, black people. And until they do matter to black people, they will matter to no one else, and I don't know that they should. And I look at Congressman in New York, I'm here, Congressman Charlie Rangel, never spoke out one word to support not only black political prisoners, but people in our community He spoke out against community control. I know, I was there. And when I was on my way to jail, his statement was, we don't have time for the job of one little black boy. I tell you, I was not a boy for many a year. And it was never about a job for me. It was about community control for his community in Harlem, the community he claimed to represent. And that was the issue. Never was it anything else. And he betrayed it, and he is still in Congress. But why should we be surprised? Because we talk about the anatomy of colonialism. And this is a perfect story of the anatomy of colonialism. If you become an elected representative of the black community and you really begin to represent that community, they can find a traitor to the black community to sell you out. A witness, Adam Clayton Powell, being sold out by Charlie Rangel, Reverend Butts, and the black political community to the white establishment. They didn't like what Adam was doing, so they found it easy to find Joe Overton, Charles Rangel, and as I say, Reverend Butts, to sell him out, because as long as Adam was on the ballot, he could be elected. But the people that he had charged with getting petitions sabotaged it. And I say again, let us be clear, Ralph said it. Charlie Rangel, Reverend Butts, Joe Overton, and the Democratic Party of the time. They sabotaged Adam Clayton Powell. And let us jump forward many years. We had the Honorable Cynthia McKinney from Atlanta. She won. She began to represent the people of her community. And the Democratic Party went after her, and they beat her in the primary. And she came back and beat them in the primary. And they came back with your president, Mr. Obama, who was at the time a congressperson. And he came and campaigned for her enemies in Georgia. Who are your friends? And this is the anatomy of imperialism, colonialism. They can always find someone to sell you out. Now, this is not only in America. This is the anatomy that is practiced around the world. And let us go back. We're concerned about the issues of a treaty or an understanding with the country of Iran. And so let us look at the history in Iran. And I look at the history for the anatomy, to make you understand the anatomy of imperialism and colonialism, because in Iran at the time, they had a democratically elected government, and the head of that government said he wanted a certain dollar amount, penny amount on the dollar of oil. The corporations and the Americans didn't want to give him that, and so they overthrew him and put in a caretaker government, the Shah of Iran, and he stayed there until the people of Iran threw him out. The same formula worked in Iraq. They had a democratically elected government, but America overthrew him, and who did they put in? Saddam Hussein, who did their bidding. And as long as he was willing to do their bidding, they were happy with him. And when he decided to get his oil, and that's another story that we cannot go into tonight, they overthrew him. The anatomy of colonialism. And you can trace this. Egypt, around the world, they do the same thing over and over again, but it does not always work. The anatomy of colonialism and importing of drugs by the Europeans into China with Chiang Kai-shek was the way it worked. And Mao Zedong came in and beat them. They tried the same thing in Vietnam with Ki and Tu and 100 other colonial administrators until Ho Chi Minh and his organization beat them. And we are in the same position today, and time is running out for us, our political prisoners, those who understood, who knew and did what we claim we are talking about when we have a 1,000-man march and a 1,000,000-woman march and 2,000,000 men marches, and all of our people are still in jail because when election time comes around, we run in and we pull the lever for a colonial administrator who will not support our people. Do not be a part of that anatomy. Break the chain. Fight out against that. For wake up. Now is the time. And I will wait to discuss these other issues which you have been presented with our other people on the line. And I'm going to leave it to Betty Davis of the New Abolitionist Movement that was formed many years ago to do what? To destroy and abolish miseducation in New York City. We lost. And what do we have today? We have ministers, unions, and everyone else running to destroy the public schools by having privatization. The anatomy. This is the way it works, the anatomy of colonialism. And I wait for Betty of the New Abolitionist Movement. It was formed many years ago by Lynn Stewart, Betty Davis, and myself. And we're still working on it. Take over from there, Betty, because I'm getting worked up when I say, don't get me started, and you have gotten me started. Go ahead, Ms. Davis.
Well, I'd like to say you have a full house, Brother Ralph. We want to greet, and some of your mics are open, but not all of them, because I want to cut down on background noise. We have Sister Lynn in the house. We have Brother Dick Minnelli in the house. We also have Sister Mary Neal. We have Brother Joel Myers. We also have, as usual, our stalwart revolutionary Brother Larry Pinckney in the house. And I would like to add, we have some other guests ending in 0411. Last four digits of the line is 0411. We want to greet them. And the last four digits of the second guest are 4407.
That's me.
Brother Ralph, hello?
I'm here. Go ahead, Betty.
I want to suggest that we give Sister Lynn a chance to get on for us. And before she does, I'd like to make you aware that we received an email this afternoon saying that there was a victory in California. I imagine Sister Lynn can update us on that in terms of confinement and solitary confinement. So I imagine Brother Larry Pinckney and or Sister Lynn can bring us up to date on that. Sister Lynn, would you like to take over?
Yeah, I'm on the line.
I'm here.
Ann, were you...
Well, I don't. It doesn't matter which of us
victory.
Goes.
Go ahead, Lynn.
Okay.
Or Ann. Do you want Ann or Lynn, Ralph? Call us
Ann,
out.
Ann, go ahead, Ann. I'm waiting for you, Ann.
No,
we
I thought Lynn was
going to
do the
weeks.
California prisoners. I'm only just now getting in and looking at the email. So
okay. Why don't
look
we let Lynn?
Lynn, go ahead.
Let Lynn go ahead, and then I have
As many of you know, I am in the North Country, and thus I'm not really tuned in, except as many of you are, to the radio and the reports that we've heard. But what we heard is that a judge in California has ruled that solitary confinement, and particularly noticing that at Pelican Bay, that is based upon one-time gang affiliation, in many cases 30, 40, 50 years ago, and they, of course, consider the Black Panther Party gang, is not warranted, and within 1 year it must be ended because it amounts to cruel and unusual punishment. This is a fight that many, many of us have fought for many years, claiming that what happens when you lock a person in a narrow room, allowing them out 1 hour a week to take a shower and having no physical contact with any other human being is torture, and we know it has gone on. We are particular in noticing it in California, in the Pelican Bay situation. Our dear Hugo Pinnell, who died recently, he was a victim of solitary confinement. And, of course, the Angola 3, outrageously, and as depicted in a mock-up of the cell in which Albert Woodfox was being held, 8x3 by something just outrageous, like being in a coffin 24/7. I mean, you can't imagine it, I can't imagine it, and I've been to jail. But to be locked up in solitary confinement is now considered by at least one court to be cruel and unusual punishment. We will see what happens next. We, of course, who have been around, and I include all of your guests, Ralph, as well as yourself and Betty, we know that many times these decisions by courts are then turned via another court, and the law is only what it is on any given day. So today, it looks very good. Solitary confinement has been found to be cruel and unusual treatment. But then again, we know by next week that may be turned around. Mm-hmm. I do want to read tonight from my good friend, of course, Mondo, in Nebraska, in solitary confinement. And I read from his book, The Black Panther is an African Cat, which is put out by Afro-American Afro Books, which you can go online and buy for the pittance, really, of $10. It's a great joy and satisfaction that his words bring. And to know this man has been locked up since he was a young fellow. He's been in jail for over 40 years. The poem I want to read tonight is short, called Bloodline. It deals with people, slaves who escaped, and what happened.
Hello?
I'm here. I'm waiting.
Oh, okay. I didn't know if I...
Hey, Ralph.
I'm listening. Okay, great. Lynn, I'm listening. What happened? Seems we lost Lynn.
She was just about to read from Mondo's book. Well,
okay, go ahead.
Speaking of prisoners and books, a lot of our prisoners are very prolific writers. My friend, Jaleel Muntakim, who is one of the New York 3... been here in prison for 43 years, since the age of 19. Actually, it's more than 43 years. He'll be 64 this year. And he has a new book, which is called Escaping the Prison, Fade to Black, which is just now, should be out by September 15th, being published by Kerplestadep, and who just put it up on his website. So people go to freejaleel.com. They can read a little bit about this book. It's not only his usual serious political writing, but also his poetry, which is pretty amazing. So it really shows, you know, how our freedom fighters are able to maintain, you know, their sanity and their humanity despite being in these horrible gulags, right? So I also just got a blog from him, which is called Black Lives Matter Forward, right? He says, after watching some of the reported discussion between Black Lives Matter activists and Hillary Clinton, I thought if there was one thing important that happened was Hillary asking those activists to provide her with an agenda and policy she could support and advocate. When considering the diverse ideological composition of the BLM campaign, it is important to review our history of struggle. For example, the civil rights movement's success was based on the development of a national coalition. The leading spokesperson came from the SCLC. The legal wing was represented by the NAACP. The youth movement component was SNCC, while CORE and the Urban League primarily assisted in organizing the urban communities and raising funds for the overall movement. Of course, there were other associated groups from churches to labor unions, etc. Yet, what was the cohesive determinant of the era of struggle was its focus on ending Jim Crow segregation. The success of the civil rights movement was its ability to identify specific racist institutions and practice and forge campaigns challenging them beyond marches and protest demonstrations. The movement proposed specific policy changes. The Voting Rights Act, the end of segregated schools, using the Commerce Act to end segregated travel accommodations, etc., were tactical successes in a broader strategic campaign to end all vestiges of Jim Crow segregation. When Clinton asked BLM activists to provide proposals for policy changes beyond sloganeering and protest demonstrations, the activists did not seem to provide an answer. And he queries that because that's, you know, what he saw. For me, that was disturbing. As she said, without such, in 10 years, we would be here again making the same arguments. The moral compass in terms of changing hearts in a capitalist social order is to demand institutional changes as the civil rights movement achieved in what I qualify as a bourgeois social democratic movement. In previous blogs, I raised specific goals to be achieved in the evolutionary political development of the Black Lives Matter movement. Since the reality is activists are challenging political candidates to raise these concerns onto a national debate, it is incumbent on BLM to forge specific national proposals and policy for these politicians to advocate if they want the support of the Black Lives Matter movement in particular and the progressive community in general. Hence, I humbly suggest the forming of a national platform and program for BLM to further substantiate the national organizing of a mass and popular movement. Needless to say, it is when diverse ideological composition...
Anne, you got to slow down. You're going so fast you can't catch the word, please.
Oh, I'm sorry. Needless to say, it is when the diverse ideological composition of Black Lives Matter begins to speak in one voice, make the same demands, and advocate for the implementation of specific policies, will the entire initiative become a formidable movement as occurred during the Civil Rights Movement. While the oppressive, repressive conditions confronting new African people are varied, there are particular concerns we must challenge in a national determination. Because of the myriad problems besetting the new African community, it would be prudent to expect Black Lives Matter to concentrate its political capital on the immediate issues most detrimental to black lives, survival, and prosperity. Therefore, in my opinion, BLM should be making the following demands and structure-specific proposal for policy development. 1. The immediate end of police profiling, brutality, and murder. Demand the decentralization and demilitarization of police. That police officers must live in the community they are assigned to patrol. Greater diversity in the hiring of police officers, more representative of the community they patrol. 2. End the school-to-prison pipeline. Demand quality education in black, brown communities, including ending discriminatory disciplinary practices and criminalizing students. 3. Student debt relief, offering greater numbers of scholarships for college entry programs to poor high school graduate candidates. 4. Stop gentrification of black, brown communities, providing secure low-income housing and stable rent control zones in targeted communities. 5. An immediate end to mass incarceration and an end to the prison industrial complex. Demand the end to corporate prisons for profit. For the implementation of restorative justice and community adjudication programs. Demand the removal of the clause in the 13th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution that permits prison slavery and involuntary servitude. 6. The development of a national job training program for the poor communities. Demand full employment with a living wage. 7. The immediate recognition of the existence of U.S. political prisoners and the immediate amnesty and release of COINTELPRO victims. Each of these issues should be developed into specific demands and proposals for policy development in the national campaign. These demands must be made part of the BLM campaign challenging political candidates. Furthermore, these demands should be talking points for all progressive groups challenging elected officials across the country toward the building of a mass and popular movement. These demands provide the BLM specific objectives to achieve to broaden full recognition of black people's human rights. Obviously, the demand for the recognition of the existence of U.S. political prisoners serves to raise consciousness on the depth and breadth of our overall struggle for civil and human rights. It challenges the U.S. corporate government's brutal repression of militant resistance to racist oppression. I sincerely hope the Black Lives Matter movement will give serious consideration to what is here proposed. At no time in the future should any candidate on the national election scene should think they can instruct Black Lives Matter activists how they should organize a challenge to the corporate government. Our history is replete with examples of successful campaigns building mass and popular movements. It is time for this generation to bring the heat, making it uncomfortable, if not impossible, for the status quo to ignore or negate the suffering of our poor and oppressed peoples. The ultimate task is the building of the socioeconomic and political institutions towards a new American revolution to demand equitable distribution of this country's wealth. Remember, we are our own liberators. In fierce struggle, Jaleel Muntakim. And I just got this in the mail yesterday.
Well, Ann, I've heard it, and I'd like to reduce it to two demands. The first demand would be community control of the schools and all of the money that is involved in there, the economics and the material to be taught there. And second, to free all our political prisoners as a sign that we are being listened to, or you can reverse that. Free all our political prisoners and community control of the schools and all of that, all involved in that. And with those two, we will achieve all of the others. It is a must, and no person should be elected to any office who claims to be represent a progressive community if we do not free our political prisoners. Let's get used to that one.
I agree.
Betty, would you carry it on? Thank you.
Yes,
oh, I just want to say one more thing. Could I just say one more thing?
Go ahead.
Very, very quickly. This is not up yet on freejaleel.com. He has blogs, but this will be posted as soon as I get the chance to retype it in. So if you go to freejaleel.com, he has a lot of writings there. He has a series of blogs. He has poetry. And he loves to have people correspond with him, like on this issue, Ralph. If you wanted to write to him and talk with him about it, he would be very happy to hear from you or anybody else. He really needs to have a lot of people engaging with him because he's an extremely intelligent, thoughtful person, and he's always having a lot of ideas, and he needs to be able to bounce them back off people.
Thanks again, Ann, and we will follow up on that. I personally am going to get in touch with Jaleel if you will help me on that situation. Betty, I think Lynn is waiting to read her poetry.
She's back online. Time here, and I know there are others.
Okay, can I interrupt
for
just a second?
It just seems that something goes wrong.
Mr. Lynn.
Week, and I know get to read the full poem.
Maybe she can't hear you.
Next time, thanks.
Lynn, they're waiting for you. Go ahead.
Can I make an announcement first?
Betty, no. Let Lynn read it, please.
Ralph, I just want to insert the fact that because of our truncated broadcast last week, I have extended some time on this broadcast, and that all of our participants for the panel will be heard. After this, I would like, after Sister Lynn, we would like to segue to Brother Larry, who will...
No,
Betty,
please segue. Put Larry on right now. I'm happy. Something goes wrong almost every week with me. I'm going to have to figure out what it is, and I'll wait till next week to figure it out. But I'm just happy for the time I had. Thank you very much. Please go to Larry now. We don't want to cut any short. Thank you, dear.
Okay, but the interesting thing, no, you don't have to cut time. I extended the time because we don't want to miss the poem. So if you feel up to it, I'll come back to you then. Okay? I think what that poem, the poetry reading is very important.
Well, I have no idea how much we got out of it. On the air, wasting more time. I'll just say, waffle tonight, and I'll be doing.
Okay, I'll mute you for now. But as I said, we tentatively have time till 9:30 tonight because we did not have a full broadcast last week. At this time, I want to acknowledge that Sister Mary Neal is in the house, and Brother Dick Millie and Brother Joel. And Brother Nash, Brother Larry, can you hear us?
I can indeed. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Yes, I can.
You're on.
Thank you very much. My love, my strength, peace, power, and liberation to you, Sister Betty, to you, Brother Ralph, and to our very endeared sister, Lynn Stewart. Look, let me just get right down to it. What I have to say, first of all, is thank you all. Thank the listening audience and all power to the people. In the spirit today, being September 1st, 2015, I would like to dedicate this to an incredible revolutionary woman who died in August, who passed on. I don't like the word died. She passed on. She transitioned. Her name was Marilyn Buck. Marilyn Buck, B-U-C-K. Look her up.
Long live.
Find out who she is, all right, and who she was, and who her spirit continues to be. I would also like to dedicate what I am saying to all political prisoners, whether it's Leonard Feltier, Sunni Afi Okole, whether it is Amumi Abu-Jamal. I mean, it's an endless list, you dig, that won't be list as, or won't be missed, as Gil Scott-Heron said. So, you know, our job, our task is a formidable one, but it is absolutely one that must be done. I listened closely to what Ann had to say, and you know what? One of the things that really struck out and stood out in my mind is that first and foremost, perhaps, we need to insist that the U.S. government, the U.S. quote-unquote Congress, that is the House and the Senate, officially recognize the fact that we have myriads, I repeat, myriads of political prisoners in this country, the United States of America. We must insist that. We must insist that this is officially recognized. Now, we've got Drone Man, Mr. Hope and Change, Barack Obama, who's droning people all over the world. But, you know, the time has come for us to mature, very quickly mature, and understand that the sellout of humanity, not just the sellout of black people are a part, an integral part of humanity. The sellout of humanity is, in fact, facilitated by people such as Barack Obama. He's not the only one, sadly, by any stretch of the imagination. However, our job, and I'm so glad, Brother Ralph, that you mentioned both Adam Clayton Powell and Sister Cynthia McKinney, who continues to fight. Our job is to ensure that our sisters and brothers understand what time it really is. And what do I mean by that? What time it is for us to wake up, stop sleeping, stop snoring, wake up and see what we are really dealing with. Imperialism, colonialism can be summed up in one word, and that word is economic, social, and political, and the word is oppression. Oppression of black, white, brown, red, and yellow people. Let us understand, with all due respect to Black Lives Matter, BLM, that when their quote-unquote leadership sat down with Hillary the Butcher Clinton, let us understand that it was Hillary Clinton who was complicitous, and I mean deeply complicitous, with the murder of hundreds of thousands of black and brown people in the North African country of Libya. Let us remember that it was Hillary Clinton who said, and I quote, "We came, we saw, he died." And by he, she was referring to the then head of state, Muammar Gaddafi. Mm-hmm. So let us have no illusions about this. Now, with respect to Black Lives Matter, I don't really know what their political ideology is or ideology plural are. I do know that without that guidance, we are, or they are, in deep, deep trouble. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to be honest. I've been honest and forthright about this. You know, so I'm going to end very quickly, I hope. But I want to say that black lives have always mattered. From
right.
little Bobby Hutton back in the 60s to another brother and sisters who were murdered in Seattle. I mean, I can go on and on and on. The 21st century does not bring about something new. And as Brother Ralph said, and I love how you put it, Ralph, black lives will only matter, and indeed all human lives will only matter, when they matter to us, and we demonstrate that. So I'm going to say again, with all due respect to BLM, watch who you're sitting with. Watch who you become pally with,
mm-hmm.
because Hillary Rodham Clinton is a butcher of black, brown, and even red and yellow people, and even white folk. So let us understand that. Let us be clear about that. I'm going to end now, and thank you all for allowing me. Next week, I'm going to be referring to some articles that I have written. I've written thousands of articles at blackactivistwg.org. Again, blackactivistwg.org. WG stands for Writers Guild. But tonight I'm going to say to all of our wonderful listeners, please go on the homepage of blackactivistwg.org. Look at the homepage, scroll down about 3 inches, and you will see something called Lifting the Veil, Obama and the Failure of Capitalist Democracy, democracy being in quotation marks. Click on that and look at, I repeat, I urge, I implore you to look at the documentary. It has a number of people in it. I'm honored to have been among the people in it. But when you click on it, simply go to the right-hand column. You can watch it online. It is worth watching. And then next week, perhaps we can talk about it, but I will have more information and specific articles, or at least one article that we can perhaps talk about. Again, my love to you, Sister Betty Davis, to you, Brother Ralph Pointer, and to our esteemed, wonderful sister, Lynn Stewart. All power to the people. Thank
all
you so
power.
Very much.
Thank you.
Okay,
so
at this
Mary.
Point,
go ahead, Betty.
Brother Ralph, I would like to
yes.
let you know that you have your guest and panelist, Brother Dick Menelli, on Human Nature, and I thought then we would give Joel an opportunity to respond, if that's all right with you.
That is fine with me. And,
and
go ahead. And I
take a moment to ask Brother Nash if he would like to have a few words. His mic is open. Bob Nash?
Yes.
Hi, Ralph.
Hello.
Lynn, Betty.
How you doing, Bob?
Love you
How
all.
You
Love the program.
Love.
First time I got into it, usually Tuesday night I'm busy. But anyway, it's great, man. But when we look back, you know, the country's based on kidnapping, slavery, and genocide, and it hasn't changed one bit. That's what Afghanistan's about, Iraq, Palestine, Africa. So what do we do with it? Well, I like how you put it, Ralph. We're going to love each other, and that gives us the power to bring this thing down, because it's got to be shut down. And the only way we're going to do it is the power of love when we unite. We didn't all come in the same boat, but we're in it now. And it cannot be reformed. It's got to be shut down. Hey, Ralph, I love you, Bob.
I like
you said enough, Bob. Shut up. So go ahead, Ralph.
I love it, Bob. You got it right. We didn't come in the same boat, but we're certainly in it. And I'd like to point out that Bob Nash is one of the people in this progressive movement that not only says things, but does things. He lets his feet.
We're all Jedi warriors, and we're fighting the evil empire. Hey, love yous all, Ralph, Betty, Glenn, good night.
Thanks again, Bob.
Love
Go ahead.
Thank you.
Love
okay,
you.
I'd
you
like to acknowledge again that Brother Nash, while he may be lacking in melanin, is not lacking in spirit. As an ex-Vietnam veteran, he has marched for peace. He was part of the vigil like Paulette Gatul in Washington. He almost never missed a day of standing in the heat in front of Obama's palace to free Len Stewart. And I will never, ever forget the contribution and how he lifted my spirits. You talk about true humanity, a true concept of what human nature should be. Bob Nash represents that for me. And I'd like to say we've got Mary Neal standing in the wings. She's doing an incredible job of researching what's going on with immunizations. But before we do that, I'd like to let Brother Menelis know that we're going to open up the mic for him, and I want to acknowledge that we do have more time, but we can't use a whole half an hour of it. We have extended our broadcast tonight by 30 minutes, so at 10, if you can hang in there with us, we would appreciate it. But we would like everybody to be cognizant the way Brother Larry Pinkney is, that there are many people who want to contribute on this panel. So, Brother Minnelli, your mic is open.
Yeah, hi, everyone. I'm very, this is all very interesting, and I've enjoyed everything that everyone has said. And it's instructive. I have a couple of points. I have, if anybody is interested, I have a tape of 8 or 9 minutes from the Lawrence O'Donnell show on MSNBC where two young Black Lives Matter activists were presenting their case. And they and Larry O'Donnell commented that although he's heard a lot of these young people speak, that this was the first couple. They were up in Massachusetts and the Boston situation then. And I remembered because the young man was born in Newburyport where my mother was born. So anyway, the point was is that they had a 10-point program. And I have a tape of that section of the show. I happen to have saved the show, so I retaped it and made an MP3 file. And if anyone wants to hear just how right on these two young activists are with respect to the 10 points that they mention, some of which we've already heard tonight suggested by other people, and then I can make that MP3 file available to them if they contact me at dickminerly@gmail.com and request it. The other thing is we
summary, Dick.
Well, I would have to try to find the tape and get the whole 10 points again, and I can't do it. That's all I can say is that both the young man and the young woman who were there were sharp. And Larry is quite right. They need leadership. They need leadership of more experienced people who see other sides of the issue, you know, who see and understand what we're really doing politically. Now, I remember I started organizing parents because I had given up on architecture after 5 years of school at Pratt Institute. I decided I had no intention of being an architect. The community I was living in, which was kind of squeezed between Bed-Stuy and Fort Greene, obviously had so many problems that I wanted to help with those problems. And I had been reading moral essays and got all fired up that it was my responsibility to go out in the streets and help. And that's when I began to start organizing parent organizations and dealing with the school crisis. Well, I did that in 1963 while Ralph Pointer was in Harlem, and he told us one night that that's exactly when he started with his activism. And he and I both worked until we met in 1967 and realized we were kindred spirits. And I said, thank God. I said, I've been fighting a real battle here, that even though all these parents were behind me and these community organizations and parents associations were in my organization and we were making progress, firing incompetent principals. We even fired the district superintendent, and we had a lot of, and the system was coming in on us. And I said, but nobody here understood, you know, what I understood about what was happening politically. And until I met Ralph Pointer and got introduced to his Teachers Freedom Party, and I met Lynn Stewart and Betty Davis, and, you know, Harvey Shapiro, who's no longer with us, and Sol Yurick, the novelist, who's no longer with us, all these brilliant people talking to us about the. Now, I think the young Black Lives Matter activists need this kind of assistance from people with experience also, because I was looking very hard for it, and I didn't find it for 4 years. Although we did a good job of organizing, we didn't do the right job politically. And anyway, be that as it may, I'm supposed to say something about human nature, so I'm going to cut it very short. My book explains this all. If you want to know more about it, as I said last week, I think it was, or the last time we talked, I have a selection of the political excerpts from the later part of my book after I've talked about what people are. And I want to remind everybody that you cannot propose political solutions unless you first understand human nature, because you're just repeating the mistake that has been made by millennia of people who mistook the whole thing. How can you propose how to organize a society correctly and make a suggestion as to where we should go in the future unless you understand what people really are? Well, your psychologists and astrologists and other human scientists and geneticists and everything, they haven't helped you here. They have then helped any of us in understanding what we're really all about. And I think my book, Human Nature, A New Theory of Psychology, moves us along in that and would let the discussion go on. But I've got a couple of important points there here on this. What I know as a consequence of my analyzing human character. Now, I see character as different from personality. Modern psychologists study personality, and that's everything that happens in your life. That's what they mean by it. They think that the things that have happened to you when you were a child and throughout your life is what makes your personality, they call it. All right, but then they confuse it with the word character, and the two words don't have any distinct meaning to them. But in my system, I say you are born with certain characteristics, for good or bad, for ill or evil, whatever it is, or we're great people or we're not, it doesn't matter. Most of us are just in the middle. And we're born with a character. And you know that you are unique, and you know that you have a character that stays with you through your life. And even at my advanced age, I look back and I say, yeah, I'm the same person I was back then. It's just I've learned some things about how to handle life, and that's a different matter. But remember this, that if you have a character, that is what allows us to say, and I'm going to tell you this without explaining why, that we have different generations. The factors that affect this innate character that we have affect us by generations also, so that some aspect of our psychological process, the process in which we are thinking about the right thing to do, our judgment process that tells us our moral views, our beliefs, what things we are hoping for in the future, all of that, our judgment process varies significantly from generation to generation. So we're battling our heads against the wall if we don't understand that some generations are innately selfish and not kind, and another, and the alternate generation, the next generation, is innately unselfish and kind, and that we run into this generational clash. between self-centered and other-centered generations, and that's been the very confusing thing in society. But we have them both in our society, and it's the people who are on the unselfish generations that go out and work for all other people. You'll find that to be so. But anyway, the important thing about this now and politically, I'm only saying that as preface to saying my conclusion. And my conclusion from the study of generations, and I have them all listed in Appendix C of my book, actually dated going back to 532 BC and going ahead to the 23rd century. And all these generations, the difference that it makes is that know that we are now entering a new era, a new psychological era, and all that we have suffered for the last 60 or 70 years with the predominant quantity of selfish people is coming to an end, and we can look forward to the fruits of our labor now. Because what we're doing now, like when Ralph and I were working in the 60s and 70s, you know, and everything else, and, you know, where we're fighting a young generation that just had no real interest in real revolution. All they were interested in ultimately were what jobs they were going to have and everything else. We had some people who did, of course, we know that. But I'm not saying that everybody is the same in a generation. I'm just saying that generally the entire generation. But now we're going to have a different situation. Within 20, 30 years, as the people born in 2008 on get a little older, we're going to have twice as many leftist inclined people as we have rightist inclined people. But we've just come out of this dark era that gave us the Tea Partiers and the people who gave us Ronald Reagan and who controlled every election from that time when Jimmy Carter was outed, and they controlled every election and dominated so much so that all the well-meaning people thought there were too many rightists here, we can't fight the rightists, so we better not challenge them. Well, I'm just saying that we have entered a new era. We're in it now, and as we patiently work along in the next 10 or 20 years, we will find increasingly that the leftist inclined people are going to outnumber the rightist inclined people, and we're going to have the opportunity to use our electoral system and everything else to make a lot of changes, because this era that we're now in is just like the beginning of the modern era that started in 1762 and gave us worldwide revolutions. We already have worldwide revolutions. All across the world, people are revolting, but they don't know what to ask for because they can't have a picture of what a just and sane society would be and why we've never had one. And that's our obligation, too, on the intellectual level, to teach people that. I just want to reassure you all that there is a better future coming, and our work will bear fruit this time, although some of us won't be around to hear it. There is one thing that I wrote, but I'm sorry, I'm trying to wrap up. There is one thing that I wrote that is of interest. I believe I wrote a letter to send it out to some news media people and to put on my Facebook page. I'm on Facebook, Dick Minerly. You know, send in a friend request. Of course, I'll accept you and everything else. I'm also restarting my blog, which is newideaspost.blogspot.com, and I put this little letter on it. And it's on the very important issue of gun control. Now, the only reason I'm going back to that issue now is not to talk about gun control, because we know where we stand. But what I'm trying to do is say I see some new things as a consequence of this, and I'd like you all to hear them. All right? So bear with me just a second. I'll run through this. It won't take long. Let's see. At a DNC convention this week, Hillary Clinton said, quote, "We need to put an end to the gun violence that plagues our communities," end quote. This is true, but only if by gun violence we also mean the attacks by law enforcement agents against blacks and other minority people. It's strange that she waited to mention this need until there was a fatal incident involving white victims that didn't require her to mention the recent murders of black citizens by racist police. So her real position on this is clear, and it contrasts sharply with the Black Lives Matter position that Bernie Sanders warmly supported at that same convention. Then she said that, quote, we must keep weapons out of the hands of the domestic abusers and the violently unstable. This merely echoes the calls by anti-gun conspirators for laws requiring, quote, background checks, which some rightist liberal states have already legislated. The greatest danger of such laws is that they are the first step in creating a national registry that will tell our centralized government the identity not only of those who were denied the right to buy a gun, but also of everyone who did buy one. And when our rightists or collectivists win control of all three branches of our government, they will suspend all of our natural and civil rights as individuals with new Patriot Acts, and then use that registry to seize everyone's weapons. But there's another basic flaw in those background checks that goes unmentioned in the media, namely that today no legislation can be correctly written and fairly enforced as regards mentally disturbed people. This is so because notwithstanding nearly two centuries of academic propaganda to the contrary, no philosopher or human scientist has ever explained human nature fully and truly. Therefore, we cannot logically assume that our scientists' current ignorance and ex post facto or empirical methods will allow them to judge people correctly and to do so before the fact, which is when it really matters. Moreover, if it is true, as researchers recently reported, that 70% of all murdered people in the U.S. were family members or lovers of the murderer, background checks will require a vast expansion of our family and social counseling programs, and this will produce an even greater intrusion by our government into our minds and private lives. As a philosopher, humanist who tries to reason deeply and fairly on all issues, I can see no logical or moral validity to the old arguments by rightists, including Obama, Hillary Clinton, Biden, and other establishment Democrats, that we need more laws to restrict gun ownership. As individualists, we leftists know better than to let our state have such total power over our natural inalienable rights and hence our thoughts, beliefs, and life decisions. I'm almost finished. I consider my core belief here to be a fundamental principle of any truly sane and just society that anyone could ever conceive. As Jefferson put it, the strongest reason, quote, the strongest reason for the people to retain the right to keep and bear arms is, as a last resort, to protect themselves against tyranny in government, end quote. But we must go further than that. For the right to own weapons is an inalienable right of every individual who was born anywhere, just because it is the right of self-defense. That right is as natural and inalienable as eating, sleeping, loving, and breathing. So why should we surrender it to the massive centralist government that rightist elitists created for us in 1787 and hope to rule us with forever? The gun restrictions proposed by our collectivistic rightists, whether liberals or conservatives, are irrational because they put the cart before the horse. Only after they have helped us establish a moral government that serves and protects every individual equally can they reasonably ask us to lay down our arms. All right, that's all I have to say
well,
tonight.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Dick. But the last sentence, that serves and protects all of us equally.
That's
and this
right.
is the crux of the problem. And we'll
exactly.
go to Emerson when he says, truth is the summit of being and justice is its application to affairs. And we see it has always been the application of the truths that America believes in has a double standard. One application
yep.
for you and a different application for me. So we must
the very
get
interesting.
To the root of do we
yeah,
must
the very
get
interesting
to the root
thing.
Of that.
I'm sorry,
and that brings me to where
no,
we
an interesting
are
fact.
Psychologically.
Yeah, let me mention an interesting fact that relates to that. Go ahead.
In America
ahead.
Today,
sorry.
Where Mr.
Yeah.
Trump is a leading candidate of the Republican Party, and we know what he is about and
yes,
his
absolutely.
Double standard. And so we must understand that everything these people say, and when I say these people, I'm talking about politicians, there's a double meaning. And Trump, and we must, as was pointed out in this program before, Donald Trump, when the Central Park jogger issue came up, he called for the death penalty for these five young men, and then we found out later they were innocent.
They weren't.
Where
that's
was
right.
his application of truth to affairs? And when we have these people killed by the army of occupation called the police, somebody says, well, they kill everybody. And I says, well, you're more likely to be killed if you have color. And
well, that army of occupation, let me just make a point, Ralph. That army of occupation has on their vehicles to serve and protect. So that's why I use those phrases.
Yes, and to serve and protect the corporate interest is what it has
precisely.
Always been, and we have been through that. And the fact that the American public finds this guy acceptable, along with a Giuliani, which who never led the primaries. But he was a presidential candidate after this man had called the dumb Dave Dinkins, I called the mayor of New York. He was mayor of New York, and he called him a janitor, and on the steps of City Hall, he called him a nigger. And yet he could aspire to be president with a background like that because of the mindset of the American people. And I
but
looked
that time
at
was
to see as a barometer of the mindset of American people. And as far as I'm concerned, he said just one thing that was partially correct when he said the people of these hedge funds contribute nothing, they take everything, they do
that's
nothing,
right.
and they should be taxed because they produce nothing. And this is, he came close, so, but
well,
it's not the real truth because he should have gone further with that. But he got
his character is so conflicted. His character is so conflicted that he will occasionally say something that's valid, but he can't put it in the right context. He's got an inner conflict.
Gentlemen, Brother Ralph,
go ahead.
I want to let you know that
I hear you, but
we're moving down the line in terms of time, and Brother Richie is in the house, and Brother Joel Myers. And we definitely want to hear from Sister Neil regarding this immunization threat that affects all of our health. So at this
point,
we have time. Up and hold it.
I want to acknowledge Brother Joel, because I want to leave people time to come back and comment on anything they heard in the show this evening as part of our wrap up. So Brother Joel Myers, your mic is open. And Brother Richie, you're next?
Yes. Hello.
Go ahead.
Hello.
We're here, Joel. Go ahead.
Yes. I was listening to this very deep philosophical discussion. I have to say a lot of it, it's difficult to it's very deep, so that when you hear a stream of it coming pretty quickly, sometimes you get left a little bit in the dust. At least maybe you don't, but I do. But I just want to, I have a few questions, though, as to some of the things that were being said. For example, this whole idea of, I think if our problems are really just a result of innate character of different people, which may vary from one generation to another, or human nature itself, then it's very difficult to just within that framework to imagine what a solution could be or how we could work toward a solution, because I don't think if there's a human nature which is innate and unchanging, and individuals have an unchanging character, then it would be very difficult to figure out a way to change the behavior or to hello?
What Joe, my dear friend, I want to tell you, yes. Joe, I just want to tell you.
Well,
that
let him finish. Let him finish.
Oh,
please.
Yes, yes, of course. Go ahead.
Go ahead, Joe.
Go ahead, Joe. Go ahead. Finish.
So I would question some of that, and also some of the things that were said in the previous previous discussions. For example, I believe that the idea that the individualistic is the truly progressive, while the collectivistic is reactionary or anti-progressive in some way. I think that it's the opposite of what many people in the progressive movement have believed for a long time. Not that I think that under the capitalist state, that collectivism, if it's led by the state, could have a very rigidifying and tyrannical dictatorial character, whereas the collectivism in terms of organizing humanity as one big family where people look out for each other's interests rather than trying to be individualistic and taking as much for ourselves as we can without so much as a thank you is not really, and even within the capitalist state framework, I don't consider people like the Ayn Randists or like a lot of the most reactionary Republicans today and conservatives, what they're putting out is the idea of deregulating the rich and allowing the individual to do whatever they want. And even though that might sound egalitarian because everyone is looked at as an individual, but this is an old saying that I once heard, that let each person for him or herself set the elephant as he danced among the chickens. And I think that when people have amassed, and not only people, but institutions like corporations and banks have amassed billions of dollars that are nominally private property, they tend to make all of society into private property. And the only solution I could see is to take those disproportionate amounts of wealth away from them and divide them more equally among the regular people. So,
yes.
Yes.
Look, can I answer, Joe? I just want to say that I have answered all of these issues clearly in my book, and you would see the whole picture better if you saw it. I can't possibly elaborate what's in a 500-page book in these shows. I'm just giving you conclusions, and if they interest you, you will trace them down. Individualism is the key to having a just society because it proposes not a false altruism or a false egoism. It proposes a fair balance between both impulses in people. And I understand this.
I would like to be very quick and short.
Yes, please do.
Okay,
please do.
Let me interrupt here for a minute, Betty, and just say this. We all are what we do. We can talk theoretically about things, human nature, etc., but we can look reality as to solutions. Now, within this capitalist system, we saw solutions that people liked. For example, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who had excess profit tax to make things more just. Otherwise, if you were making a lot of war profits, you had to be taxed. We are without even a semblance of any type of justice, and this is the mindset of the American people to accept that. But I'll let it go with that. Go ahead. Go to the next guest, Betty. Go ahead to the next guest. Betty. Hello.
She was going to call Richie, I understand.
Yes, Brother Betty. Richie. Brother Richie,
hi, everybody. Hi, how are you?
I want to, Richie.
How is everybody?
You got him, Betty. He's on.
Short.
Can you hear me? Okay.
Yes,
I just wanted to say that we need to remember the assassination murder of our comrade Hugo Pinnell, who was murdered by two neo-Nazis in a California prison, and he was set up by our own governor, who used to have a show on BAI called Jerry Brown, and I've not heard BAI even talk about his assassination. I've been trying to get the information from friends and other anarchists who do political prison work like I do. And we need to remember him. It was a setup, and he was murdered by two neo-Nazis who were in every prison, and apparently there was a lack of protection of him from the guerrilla army. This was an inside job, and no one's talking about it. He was 70 years old. He was one of the two survivors of the Soledad brothers, and I'm going to try and pull a tribute together to Hugo Pinnell somewhere, and anybody who wants to help me can. And also I want to announce there will be a showing of Leonard Peltier's life at Blue Stockings at 7 p.m. next Saturday, and also the Black Panther movie is going to be at the film forum, and we will be outside, and I will be inside when I have the money next week, giving out flyers about the police shutdown against police terror. We're not inviting the politicians. We're not asking people to write books about it. We are asking people just to come to New York City and shut it down. We had a rally with Cornel West, and we had families from the middle of the country that were murdered by the police. We are trying to bring other families. We are trying to bring every family we can to New York City. We are having a meeting about it this Sunday. So this is something people can concretely do. And you don't have to, anybody can come. 6 p.m. this Sunday, West Park Presbyterian Church. You can take the one train to 86th Street. 86th Street in Amsterdam. And we need to do a tribute to Hugo Pinnell. This is other people are being murdered in these prisons by medical murder. Mamiya is sick. Seth Hayes is sick. I've been doing this work for 30 years. I work with Ralph Amin. I work with Ramona in Pan Africa. And Bernie Sanders is a Zionist. He is an AIPAC supporter. He has said nothing about when Troy Davis was murdered or Tukey Williams. He is another fake leftist. He is a joke, and we should ignore the election. We should concentrate on our heroes, political prisoners. I know it had to be short.
I agree.
Wanted to get that in there.
Yes, it's important that, you know, like the Hugo Pinnell case and many others show that not only are our political prisoners being murdered by medical neglect, but they are also murdered by the manipulation of the prisons to move someone like Hugo Pinnell into an arena, into an area where the white racist what do you call them, the Aryan Nation,
neo-Nazis in the
prison, neo-Nazis in the prison. How does he happen to be there? And this is because the prisons are controlled by neo-Nazis and fascists, and when they want to get rid of you once you are in prison, this is one of the favorite methods. Suddenly, you are not with the group that you have been with over the years or you are associated with. You're locked off in an area with neo-Nazis. And I claim, and as Richie said, this is the murder of the government. Government-sanctioned murder at home. So freeing our political prisoners, getting them out of that situation is a very, very important first that we must do, because we must remember who is a political prisoner. Someone who did the things that we are talking about, that we are theorizing about. Myself, when I get off the phone, I'm going to have a nice glass of wine while our brothers are dying in jail. This is an emergency situation. We must demand from everyone that we would pull the lever for, if voting is our objective, our action. We must say that you must be willing to stand up for our political prisoners or you won't get our vote. In the words of our sister Lynn Stewart, we cannot call ourselves a movement until we get this done. And so let us work on it, and I will shut up for a few minutes. Hopefully, Betty, go on to your next guest.
All right.
Betty.
I want to... Yes, can you hear me? Hello?
Yes.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Ralph?
I can hear you. I hear you very well.
Okay.
I should go on to your next guest.
I would like to call attention to our next guest by saying she has been a longtime warrior against the vicious killing of the incarcerated mentally ill in America. And I want to commend Dick Minnelli for making that analysis that who is qualified to say what is mental illness in this country. I would put it to you that 70% of these people who are outside our mental institutions belong inside, and that most of that 70% are in Congress right now. However, I would like to call on Sister Mary Neal. Would you please give us an update on your latest discussion and concerns regarding the government's role in immunization? And I need you to keep it brief because we have to get back to Mr. Poynter. Sister Mary Neal, you're on.
Well, thank you, Ms. Betty Davis. I really appreciate it. I want you to know that every battle that I've been fighting as Director of Assistance to the Incarcerated Mentally Ill and Director of the Human Rights for Prisoners March and other organizations, every battle really comes down to one thing, and that is that our decision makers, many of them are eugenicists and depopulation supporters. And so when you look at it that way, you can understand it better. And back in the day, from the 1930s to the 1970s, America had a very active eugenicist movement where they were enforcing sterilization on certain populations, and those are blacks primarily, secondly, poor whites, and thirdly, the mentally ill or people who were labeled mentally ill. Now, these same three classifications of individuals are those who are being killed more often by police and are being subjected to mass incarceration today, because the American eugenicist movement has not gone anyplace, and in fact is more active now than ever before. However, last Wednesday we did our first show called Stop Enforced Vaccinations, Stop Mandatory Vaccinations. And that was on Wednesday night at 8 p.m. We'll be back tomorrow night at 8 p.m. at the same channel. And I want you to know that there's a bill, and I'm not sure it ever was a real bill, but it is online, pictures of it and what have you. And it's HB, that means House Bill, 15090. And this bill from 1970 was an examination of the feasibility of using AIDS to depopulate blacks in America. Also, I want you to know, Ms. Betty, that the young man that you helped us get on radio last week to discuss with his grandmother and his mother and his fiancée is still in jail. He's in jail in Tennessee. That's Bernard Johnson. He's very sick. He's got impacted bowels. He claims he's not been able to defecate in a couple of weeks. And he also has traumatic brain injury. And he was dating a Caucasian girl when he had a bipolar crisis, and he was hollering at her. Neighbors called the police, and they put him in jail for assault. And once there, they gave him a pretty high bond. He has a trust fund of hundreds of thousands of dollars, but his attorney will not release his bond money. I wrote about him today and also right after that show, and that's at Dog Justice for Mentally Ill. And the last thing I'd like to say is that I invite all of you, but particularly white people, to go and sign my pass to go into Atlanta. The name of the article is White People, Sign My Atlanta Pass. And it's in my Free Speak blog. Put that together, Free Speak blog. I need a pass signed by as many Caucasians as possible so that I can go into Atlanta and speak freely with people about giving assistance to the incarcerated mentally ill and about the Human Rights for Prisoners March. When I went there in 2010, two police officers came, black police officers, and they told me that I have no free speech rights in Atlanta, and they would taser me and arrest me if I continued to talk to people about how they treat the mentally ill of all races and how my brother was secretly arrested and murdered, and about the Cochran firm fraud. They said I needed to get my ass home immediately before they taser and arrest me. I go out in public and demonstrate when they destroy my computers or when they control my computers to the extent that they're not useful for me. And so I feel that coming on now, and I ask you to go to my Free Speak blog and sign my pass. Now, there are spots for everyone to sign it, no matter what race you are. But I just want you to know that if you're black, brown, Native American, or Asian, your vote probably won't count with the people who are going to be counting these. Only the whites count, and you count less than ever. White skin privilege is going away. They're killing young white people like they are blacks. They're killing elderly, middle-class white people in their homes. And I write about these things, and that's why they tear up my computers and attack radio shows that I'm on. So I want to thank you very much in advance for signing my pass to go into Atlanta. And I want to say that we shouldn't wait till people are dead to grandstand on their coffins. Bernard Johnson is suffering right now in Washington County Detention Center in Johnson City, Tennessee. They won't let him out of jail, and his trust attorney seems to have something going on with his trust
fund. Sister Mary Neal, at this point we want to let Brother Ralph take us out. Brother Ralph, do you want to take over? You've got 3 minutes.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes. As Mary was saying, the incarcerated, those who are incapacitated mentally, it is another crime that's going on where there is hardly recognition. There's no humanity. And as my mother used to say, we all are what we do, and nations are what they do. And if we look at the history of this American nation, and we say it is what they have done, it turns out to be a very ugly picture. It is continuing. And I will say the hope is that nobody knows when and where revolutionary change is going to be successful. Many tried. Many were unsuccessful. Many were successful. And the American Revolution was successful in that it was about their right to keep slaves. That's you and me. And it is now their right to keep cheap labor. That is you and I, you and me. I want to be correct grammatically. But we must always understand what every revolution is about. We must understand that nobody knows what can be successful. We know the Haitian Revolution was successful with Dessalines and Toussaint Louverture, and we know the countries that took that revolution back, took that revolution away. We are members of that society, and we must keep that in mind, where we are, what we are about,
and free political prisoners. Free
them
all.
Thank you, Brother Ralph.
And we
thank you. Would you give your greetings to your guests and acknowledge them for what their participation this evening?
Yeah, well, thanks, folks, and all of the people you have been listening to and all of the people that we are talking to tonight are activists. We talk theory, but we put our behinds on the line, not for 15 minutes, not for 15 days, but for our lifetime. And so if you feel that we are being too theoretical, yes, theory is important, but we are working on the reality, the real deal. One more time, free our political prisoners, free them all. Thanks.
Free them all, free all political prisoners.
Oh,